Episode 28, let's go.
Medic 1 inbound to your facility, emergency traffic with a 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. Following multiple gunshot wounds, CPR in progress, patient in basic IO in place. Stay with you in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello, and welcome to the EMS Handoff Podcast. This is David, and along with my co-host, Eric McCullough and Bradley Dean, we are your source for all things EMS. Tonight, we bring back a guest. We've already discredited the whole distinguished, just have a little bit of fun, a repeat guest that we've had from early episodes of the EMS Handoff coming back for continued effort. We'll introduce him in just a minute, but we're going to go to my co-host. We're going to go over to the west side first, Eric McCullough. We have to listen to you tonight. You've been having some audio, but Magic, we actually get to listen to you now, so...
I know. It's funny. Like, that's how technology works. It works just fine until you need it. Then it crashes. And so you have to go with the backup. Usually I talk about the weather and all that stuff, but actually just talking about being busy. Working this past week, I was like, I could not believe how many pediatric patients I had. And I guess it's because the opening of the warmer weather. So you're getting this weird confrontation of medical patients and trauma patients, and they're all converging together. So this has been kind of my week this week so far.
But it has been a nice week. We've had a little bit of rain, a little bit of cool weather. But, you know, they talk about East Tennessee or just Tennessee in general. You know, you've got like 12. Everybody says, you know, we have four seasons. You really have 12. You have winter, then you have fake spring, and then you have winter again or second winter, and then second fake spring. And then by the time you get to the third, you're finally actually into spring after that. So. You know, good weather, and let's go over to the east side and hear from Bradley Dean.
So, poured down rain here yesterday, beautiful today. We were in the trenches both days doing trench rescue again this weekend. So, but it's weather's supposed to be nice for the next week. So, hopefully, it'll be good and we can slide down to the beach maybe in the next couple of weeks.
Let's see, you know, that's what those North Carolinians are. We're going to hop on down to the beach. It's right over here. I remember that from a kid, you know, loved it. But we could, I guess we could just hop over there, but it's a little bit longer for us.
There's a lot of salt life jealousy from Tennesseans here who have those stickers.
We got plenty of real estate here. A couple hours up in the mountains, a couple hours up at the beach. So, hey.
You get it all. You get it all. All right. Before we introduce our guest, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services, have been a tremendous partner to the EMS Handoff podcast. While the EMS Handoff serves as your source for all things EMS and the podcast verse, GEMS has been an industry leader in the profession for many years. Make sure to go by their website and keep it apprised of all the things that are going on in the profession. And also don't forget to check out our fellow podcasters on the EMS Today podcast by GEMS. Make sure to go by Apple, Google, Spotify, and subscribe to this podcast. Also, don't forget about the EMS Handoff merchandise line with the Pursuit Company. I'm going to tell you all this now. Eric's going to talk about later on our quiz with our partner there. But also, they don't even know yet. Well, they know a little bit, but this coming week, we should be debuting the new EMS Handoff shirt. But you can go to the EMS Handoff gear line at Pursuit Company, pursuitoutfitters.com/EMS Handoff. Bradley Dean, no further delay. Introduce our repeat offender, our guest, repeat guest.
Well, I mean, he could be a repeat offender. Tim is the founder and CEO of Emergency Medical Solutions, an EMS training and consulting company that he developed in 2010. He's got two decades of experience in the emergency services industry. He's worked as a career firefighter, a paramedic, critical care paramedic in a variety of urban, suburban, rural, and in-hospital environments. He's got a background as a company officer and chief officer level experience, in addition to training content, delivery, and program development, spending his entire career. He's an experienced EMS operations, community paramedicine, quality assurance, data management, training, special operations, and administration disciplines, and holds current credentials as both supervising and managing paramedic officer. Tim, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, gentlemen, thanks again for having me back. I think repeat offender probably is the most appropriate term for that. So, thanks again for having me here. And just like Bradley mentioned, I've got my training consulting company, also working with another consulting company, and, kind of doing a lot of behind-the-scenes things within the industry, which I've come to enjoy. I certainly still enjoy the clinical aspect, but, I think for anyone that's been involved in the administrative side of things, once you get into the kind of the back room and you get to see all the inner workings and all the cogs that have to move in order to make an agency function and function well, it's very fascinating. So really the past 5 years of my career has been a strong shift that way, certainly doing a lot of training and doing content development for different online CE vendors and platforms, a lot of writing, and then, along with that and kind of tying into today's discussion, doing some quality assurance, and I think that's the important point that, we can emphasize that you can do quality assurance on a large scale, on a small scale, and, make it within your agency and do it effectively. Do it in a simple way that involves your crews, involves your people, and produces some data that you can actually track on the back end too. So that's kind of where, I wanted to shift some of the discussion today.
So Bradley and Eric, I'm just going to go ahead. We're going to start off. Tim did forward to me earlier that our podcast has been rated a 5. It's thorough, compliant, and complete. So anybody that's checking out, they need to make sure this is where we are. So, all right. Got to give you a little bit of laugh on that one, Tim. I see you in the background.
But. Yeah. Well, we got to laugh about the stats.
Especially after being called, so the one podcast that I miss and I get called a statistical nerd.
That's
certified statistical nerd.
Is he not? So Bradley and Tim, is he not? That's not that wasn't me. Tim's over here talking about stats, all right? He's saying we should be using stats, and I was like, wow, the other day we were talking about statistical significance. I'm like, David is all about stats. So I was like, oh, come on.
That's the joys of being the editor. You get a hold of these things and you're not even there, and all you know is your partners are tossing that out there and just to let you know,
ignoring most of things. Like, wait a minute, what do you call me?
And out of all of that, that's like the one thing that I cued in on. Yeah, I got a moment. So
Tim, you would have gotten that. Tim would have appreciated.
All right. So with all of that aside, we are going to be going into the area of quality assurance. And, so I'm going to go ahead and really kind of start with some of the, I guess, really, I don't know whether we should call them misnomers or not, but, a lot of people think that, oh, goodness, a quality assurance officer is coming to talk to me. There's got to be a problem. But Tim, let me just toss it to you first with that kind of as your segue. What is it about quality assurance that makes people uneasy, and how should we actually be doing this that people realize that quality assurance, quality improvement is truly that trying to make us better?
Yeah, and that's a good question. And to start, I guess I'll say, quality assurance, quality improvement, continuous quality improvement, whatever acronym or version of it you want to call it, for the sake of it and the context here, I'm just calling it all the same thing. So quality assurance. So, really within that context, like you mentioned, so many of us, I think, grew up with agencies that didn't really know what to do with it. And the idea of someone else reviewing your call or certainly, getting called to the principal's office, everything was seemed as punitive. The first agency that I ever worked for and spent the majority of my career with, that's exactly what it was QA was, you know, there was no defined type of call that was reviewed. All you knew was that if you got a phone call, you're going to the principal's office and you might as well have a union rep there. So, you know, it's not effective. That's no way to coach. That's no way to mentor. That's no way to retrain. That's no way to instill any positivity in anyone. And so I think the biggest misnomer that needs to be broken is that quality assurance and chart reviews and whatever you want to call it, it does not need to be punitive in nature. Now, there are certainly times where, you know, there is a line. And if you cross that line, you know, teetering back and forth on it, okay, you know, we've all been there. We've all done that. But there are times where significantly or grossly or egregiously crossing that line, well, then, yeah, you're probably going to get in trouble. But that's likely warranted. So in the other situations, the 99.something% of those times, however, where you're doing your job, you're doing it well, you're following protocol, maybe you have some deviation, maybe there's just some opportunity for some course correction, that's where positive quality assurance really comes into play. And, you know, so building into, you mentioned this podcast as a five. I agree. You guys are doing a great job. You've had an awesome lineup of people. I was very fortunate to be, I think, podcast number like 12 or 14, and then now, you know, hitting into well into the double digits for you guys. It's an honor to be back. I appreciate it. And you've had a heck of a lineup in between my two visits here. So, you know, it's a podcast I enjoy listening to. And, you know, with that, you know, there's more information out there now in the industry on data management, on quality assurance, and just overall system improvement. And I think that's what it comes down to is you know, we all want to be superb clinicians, like Julianne Stevenson would say. So we want to be superb clinicians, do a good job, and at the end of the day, have proof that we did a good job. And that's our patient care report.
So you talked about the, you know, the approach and kind of like the culture change, because I guess the migration of EMS, the way quality assurance has always been, has been more stick than carrot. I mean, and I think that's where the major frustration in quality assurance programs have come, because, you know, you do this much great, but then the first time you mess up, all of a sudden you got that quality assurance officer who's, you know, or the captain or lieutenant, whoever it is, that's talking to you. What are some carrot approaches that you've seen that worked out? I mean, I've seen like good rapport, good, you know, kind of like the copy paste, good report, good job, whatever, great way to handle. Are there any other carrot approaches that you've seen that kind of worked well?
You know, I think that being transparent is a key part of promoting or changing, shifting that culture and kind of, you know, making things much more appealing with respect to quality assurance. So as an administrator, being transparent with what your expectations are, literally, you know, putting it in writing as best as you can, trying to objectivize it. And along with that, you know, having established criteria so that people know what is going to be reviewed. Now, if you're a small enough or if you're a well-funded enough agency that you can have the infrastructure and the system of people to review 100% of your calls, then wonderful. Then you know that every call you go on is going to get reviewed by someone. You know, A shift is going to review B shift's reports or whatnot. If you know that going into it, then great. There's no surprise. Or if you know that every time you go lights and siren to the hospital transporting, that you're going to get your call reviewed, then okay. You know you need to be on your best behavior, put out a quality product, a quality report. So that transparency, I think, helps to at least start from the beginning and instill the culture of positivity. And that way, when people get messages, you know, from their PCR system or in reply, good report, bad report, you at least expect something in return. But I think the key thing to it there is also trying to objectivize something subjective. And that's kind of where developing some sort of rubric, some sort of benchmark to work off of is important.
So one of the things, and anytime we get into the realm of documentation, one of the key things that I want to talk about, especially under the, as you mentioned, the quality assurance, whatever name that you're going by, we are not talking about looking at these run tickets for the purposes of billing support. That's not quality assurance. That is not what we're actually taking a look for that documentation. So what we're talking about is, as you kind of mentioned, if you're not able to review 100% of those calls, what calls are being reviewed and what are we looking for? So ultimately, our goal would be similar to watching film in the NFL, that whenever something happens, you go back and look at the information. You have that quarterback's coach or that, you know, positions coach like, look, if you would have done this, this, or this, this would have occurred, and, you know, we would have scored versus getting sacked or getting intercepted or something like that. That's really it. It's looking at that game film, and our game film just happens to be run tickets.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. You know, with respect to your patient care report, your PCR, and, you know, and talking in generalities with not only the drop-down stuff, but also the narrative, you know, there are, I guess, three major functions of it. You know, there's a billing aspect, which is certainly important. You know, that's how we get paid. That's how we get the bills, you know, taken care of. So billing is absolutely important. And it's, you know, it's only becoming more apparent and more important, too. The other aspect of that is the clinical side, making sure that you did a good job. You upheld the standard of care. You followed protocols. And so that is largely the part of, you know, the discussion for here. And then the other part of it is the medical legal side, which, you know, the significant majority of your reports, you know, the odds of you going to court over something are very slim. However, there are, I would bet, more times than not that your report actually does see a courtroom or a deposition, or at least the hands of a lawyer. So, you know, I mean, it probably is fair to even bet that majority of the motor vehicle collisions you go on, if you transport someone, you know, there's insurance monies being transferred, bills being paid off of that, they're going to want to see a report. So you may not know about it as the clinician, however, your administration does know about it. So, you know, covering the basis from those three aspects, but really focusing on the clinical side, that's the part of quality assurance that we, I think, have failed to talk about over the past decade or so. Or even, you know, longer than that. It's gotten significantly better in the past 5-10 years, and certainly some agencies are ahead of the curve. But, you know, prior to that, you know, completing a patient care report was really there, one, for medical legal, you know, so that we could threaten everyone with, well, what if you go to court? And then two, you know, being able to bill. But as we really focus on evidence-based practice, as we focus on improvement in actual patient outcomes, you know, that clinical component is the important part that we need to emphasize even more going forward.
So let's go ahead and jump right into that. One of the things we're going to discuss tonight is your PCR grading rubric that you use as part of your introductory quality assurance workshop. So let's kind of talk about that and get into how that's implemented within your quality assurance programs. So if you would, if you don't mind, go ahead and give us a kind of an overview and how that gets implemented.
Absolutely. So, you know, with your patient care report, again, two primary functions or areas of it, the drop-down stuff, you know, the area that you want to make the red go away on, entering the patient information, the demographics, the history, all the drop-down tabs of I assessed this, I did that, here's my interventions. And then the narrative being the second half of the report. So giving credit where it's very much due, when I worked with Centura Health in Colorado, especially in the South Denver market, working with a couple of agencies there, Castle Rock Fire, Larkspur Fire, Franktown Fire, and a number of folks in those agencies, Dr. Gary Witt and Mike Grill and Stuart Mills and a number of organization heads, they were huge and key with pushing and promoting the idea of let's do an in-house review, and not only with that, doing an in-house review, but let's try to somehow objectivize the subjectivity. And so within their system, they promoted a zero through four scale. And I've made some modifications to that. And what I've embraced and am emphasizing and promoting to agencies is essentially a one through five scale rating on your patient care report. And it's based off of two primary factors. Is it compliant and is it complete? And compliance with respect to protocol and standard of care. So did you do the right stuff? Did you do good care for your patient? Or, you know, did you deviate? But then also at the same time, did you justify the deviation? And that can be okay. And then the completeness. Making the red go away is one part of the report. And, you know, you can't submit until the red goes away and you have 100%. But that doesn't mean that your narrative is quality. You can make all the red go away and have 100%, you know, rating according to your PCR vendor. But if your narrative is crap, then it doesn't do anyone any good. So working off of those two factors and kind of building up that scale, and if anyone's familiar with 2x2 tables, essentially we're kind of working with a format where, okay, was this report compliant and complete? Great. If so, if it was compliant and complete, that gets a score of 4. Now, again, I said a 1 through 5 scale, so 4 is great. 5, however, is gold star. That's extra. So that's thorough, complete, and compliant. No questions. You could read this report, and any one of us could imagine walking into this home, open the door, walk in. The wife met us and led us to the patient, who was a 65-year-old male. We found sitting upright on a chair in the kitchen, clutching his chest, leaning forward, appearing ill, and saying, "I have chest pain." Like, you can walk through this report and have zero questions after the fact. You could come back to it in a year from now and probably at least vaguely remember some of the details. So that's a stellar, thorough report, a grade of 5. But the overall goal would be a 4, which is complete and compliant. Less than 4, so 3, would be still compliant, but maybe not complete. You know, you met the protocol stuff, you checked all the boxes there, but there's some detail in the report that you kind of wish was included. You only gave one nitroglycerin for the chest pain patient. Well, protocol says you can give 3. Why didn't you give more? That might just be as simple as you had a 3-minute transport time, or blood pressure was, you know, decreased. And yes, some of that stuff is in the drop-down part of the PCR, but if the picture is not adequately or appropriately painted in the narrative, that's the, I would argue, the most important part. And having worked in the hospital setting and done QA specifically within this hospital setting, when we had patient care reports automatically transferred in through a health information exchange, automatically transferred in or real time, those reports, the physicians and many other people would go immediately to the narrative because that's where they knew they would get the story, not just having the data cipher through. So the narrative is the most important part, I would say, of the clinical care aspect. All the other billing stuff, that's drop-downs. So when you don't have a compliant report, it might still be very thorough, but it's not compliant. That would be like a graded score of 2. That one, you know, you're probably going to get a talking to by someone, you know, with a gold badge or someone in a white shirt. And that's appropriate, but that's more of a coaching situation. If it's not compliant and not complete, or if there was even some negative, you know, harm that was caused, that's certainly a call that warrants review, just because of the poor stature of it. But also warrants review, you know, with the idea that you're probably going to get called to the principal's office. So. There, at least, you know, we're objectivizing something that is otherwise subjective.
I got a question. So there's, I guess, whenever I was teaching students about the value of documentation and stuff, they would come back from different EMS organizations and they'd be like, don't double document. If you did the drop downs, don't put it in the narrative. You're just creating more work, more hassle for yourself, opening yourself up to more litigation, things like that. However, I've also seen where, you know, really good, well-written narratives. I've always had, my narratives were always really long and stuff. I needed to be drawn out. So you say that's really valuable. Would you say that that's like, even if you are double documenting, that's still a good thing to do? Like, it's still a good practice, as long as you're obviously not contradicting yourself. Like you said, gave one nitro, but the dropdowns show three.
Yeah, and that's a very good question. I get asked that a lot. So double documenting is not necessary, but I'll put an asterisk by that. So not necessary in the sense of verbatim. However, whenever you do something or you don't do something based off of whatever you documented in the dropdowns, it warrants clarification. So, you know, you can be on scene and you can do vital signs every 5 minutes on someone. So you need 10 times throughout the course of your patient care. Good God, please do not put all of that in your narrative. Don't put every blood pressure every time. No, just don't. However, if the first blood pressure you got was 124 over, 72, and then you gave a nitroglycerin and now the blood pressure is 96 over 40, that's very appropriate to say initial blood pressure was this. Gave nitroglycerin approximately 4 minutes later on, repeat blood pressure found this. That's why you did not give another nitroglycerin. So when it's more of a cause and effect relationship, then documenting or double documenting is absolutely appropriate, and I would even say is critical, because again, the narrative tells the story, and we should be writing the narrative. For one, I strongly believe chronological and chronological format, and that's my personal preference, but I think also the industry pushes toward that. But we need to be writing the narrative as if someone else is going to be reading it, because someone else is going to be reading it. You would be surprised, and I think we don't emphasize enough, that once you hit submit on your report, it goes to billing folks, it goes to other people, hopefully within your agency, but then once the hospital gets that report, which typically is a state mandate, they have to get it within, 24, 48, 72 hours, that's the goal. But once your hospital gets that report, especially on higher acuity calls, trauma alerts or code STEMIs, whatever you want to call those things, on higher acuity calls, a high trauma call, I would bet that no less than four physicians are reading that report as soon as they get their hands on it. And then you still have trauma coordinators and data registrars and a whole bunch of other people on the backside. So five, six people at least are reading your report, ciphering through it for data and for key information, or even just for the context of patient care. So, that double documentation, I wouldn't even call it that, because really it's just appropriate elaboration of what the dropdowns show, if that makes sense.
And with that, you have to be willing as a provider, because I have been informed, as Eric was talking about, we've got some individuals out there that, or some organizations out there that have said, if it's in one place, don't. But none of those have ever said, like you said, very specific, significant points, don't document that. And, you make a very valid point, like multiple eyes are going to read this. So what is the sake of, Tim and I, you and I are on the truck together, and we get a call and we've gone to STEMI and we've gotten done and I complete my report and I hand it over to Tim and say, hey, Tim, take a read of this. Can you understand it? Because if your partner doesn't understand it, then chances are the next iteration, whoever that is, your QA person or your billing or somebody there is not going to get it either.
Absolutely. So I would strongly suggest that your partner on the call reads your report as well. And they should be, at the end of it, signing to at least attest they were on that call. And I think that's an important thing. And certainly those, a shameless plug for the Certified Ambulance Documentation Specialist course, those are points that are emphasized there. So with, that kind of check and balance, that way, yes, someone else can follow along to make sure that indeed that you did hit the high points, didn't miss any of the key details related to the call. Those are all, you know, key things that we should be documenting in there. And, you know, again, painting that picture so that others, not just lawyers, but others in the healthcare community and industry can follow it and have a flow to it. And I think that's the important point of doing a chronological narrative. So, you know, with the chronological narrative, again, personal preference, but then also my professional recommendation, doing something and documenting chronologically, you can't go wrong in doing that, because all you're doing is pretty much taking what you put in your flow charts and your drop downs and just putting extra words, putting context to it. So it's a natural flow, as opposed to SOAP and chart and I chart and chart E and I SOAP and whatever other stuff is out there. There's a lot of bouncing around, and it's hard to read that, and it leaves a lot of questions. And questions are not good when it comes to reporting. Questions are not good when it comes to documentation, because it leaves that an element of interpretation open for someone else to look at. And I've seen some reports that have been just so egregiously horrible where the clinician literally just put chest pain protocol followed or standard protocol followed. For one, that's horrible. That's negligent, you know, with the context of report writing. It speaks to the character of what type of clinician you are, but it leaves so many loose and open ends that, to me, that's a challenge accepted. So if you're going to just say standard protocol followed or chest pain protocol followed, okay, game on. So let's talk about your chest pain protocol. You said you followed your chest pain protocol. Tell me it. Tell me every single bit of it. I want to hear all of it. Tell me your chest pain protocol. From start to finish, you said you did this, so let's talk about this. And you know, it's one thing to be, you know, in the hot seat in front of, you know, an administrator, but it'd be another thing to be in that courtroom where a lawyer is tearing you apart saying, okay, you said you did this, so there you go. And it's much better, it's safer to actually document what you did indeed do rather than leave it open for speculation. You know, and we talk about documentation and, you know, we always threaten or say that, you know, if it wasn't documented, then it didn't happen. But also the other side of that, too, is that if you did document it, then it sure as heck better have happened. So certainly don't exaggerate things. Don't lie. Don't try to make your report more billable just because, you know, you think you should. That's called fraud. Do a good job. Write things down as they happen. Give detail as it's needed. And certainly if it drives your clinical decision-making, if it drives what you did as far as an intervention or did not do, then document it.
This might be a good time to make, you probably will agree with this. Actually, I can ask if you agree or disagree, but the copy paste. So you know what I'm talking about. People who have built Google templates or whatever templates for medical calls, trauma calls, calls that they go on all the time, they build templates for. They'll copy and paste those things. And I don't, for one, have at the core of it, I don't personally have an issue with it if you know what things to fill in or fill out. But have you seen that work? I'm sure you've seen it both ways, work to advantages and disadvantages. I used to teach my students that, like, until you learn your own process, it probably is good to have some type of template to go off of and then just kind of fill in and out. But I also see at 2 o'clock in the morning when you've run 10 calls, that is awfully, because you're paying attention to detail in a way that you don't want to anymore. The adrenaline rushes down. I keep disappearing. The adrenaline rushes down and you're really not paying attention. So have you seen that gone awry before when people use the copy paste method?
Yeah. You know, I've seen it done well. But then again, you know, as a clinician or as the documenter, you've got to pay attention to detail. But I've also seen it go horrible where it's been a cut copy paste and forgetting to remove some of the components, I think is the biggest part. even taking a step backwards and saying that auto narration, I'm comfortable with going on the record and saying that I adamantly oppose auto narration, just because it does not portray the picture. It takes what was done in or documented in your flow charts and your dropdowns and adds, you know, words like the and a and is and that and what. So no, it does not produce a quality report.
I feel like those auto narration things would be like Siri trying to take over and do your narrative for you, misinterpreting things, not even like, you gave hydrochlorothiazide, they turn it into something completely different. I see what the issue is with auto narration.
Yeah, and you know, as an administrator, if that was part of my purview and oversight, I would turn that function off, disband it, allow it, and delete it in any way I possibly could. But you know, as far as other forms of templates, you know, I think it's there's a time and a use for it. But I would also argue that if you stick with just documenting things chronologically, that you won't need to follow anything else. And I say that especially for, you know, many people in our industry are firefighters as well. So there's a difference between fire documentation, narration, or working on a NIFRS, National Fire Incident Reporting System, versus documenting on a PCR. Using SOAP and chart, you know, doesn't translate over to, you know, NIFRS reporting very well. However, documenting chronologically, you know, you arrived on scene, or you even before that, you were dispatched to this, you responded and arrived on scene and found this. Next paragraph, you did this in the house, or on scene, you did this stuff. After that, in the ambulance, you did this stuff. You found these things. Secondary assessment revealed this. And then in transport, you know, maybe it was a short transport, short paragraph, that's simple. And then you got to the hospital and then did this. You know, sticking with that format all the time and somewhat of a template in itself, I think is easy to follow. And then, you know, once you get used to it, it flows. And it's easier for us to keep the story straight in our head when we write it down that same way, just in order. You know, we did these things here. It correlates to, you know, what you have in the dropdowns. So just follow the order. Say things and present things like you did them and when you saw them. And if, you know, if you didn't check the patient's back until you got into the ambulance, okay, but, you know, that's fine. Document it that way. And, you know, if now you found that there's bloody mess on their posterior, then, okay, you noticed that, and you wouldn't have noticed it outside or prior to that because you were outside where it was dark and it was a motor vehicle collision at 2 in the morning. So that's okay. Just document it when it happened and when you saw it. And so keep everything in the context and the storyline so that it flows. And that, you know, that builds into just that's quality that is easy to follow, and it promotes a complete report because you're just telling things like they were. And in that order.
I know that when I have done some QC of our clinical reports for our students in the field, some of the things when they try to use the others, as you mentioned, SOAP chart, most of ours use a chart or the variation I chart, some of the others. But you get into a lot of things that because of that confusion, they add a lot of things in the treatment section that are actually assessment, and a lot of stuff in assessment is treated. And it really creates this just little bad pattern where, you know, the reader is having to search and find that information. So let's kind of change directions just a little bit, because I want to get into utilizing these a little bit more than just, you know, Tim, the QC officer, you know, calling up Eric for his problems that he's caused and kind of talking about how we can utilize this data. But before we do that, I kind of want to talk about being selected for that position. So we kind of talked at the beginning, kind of those misnomers about QC being that stick, you know, whack-a-mole, you know, hey, you got a problem. To changing that mentality to the carrot side that, hey, this is to make us better. Now we call up and say, okay, Tim, you're recently being promoted and you're going to be put in that QC spot. You know, that's an opportunity. That's a growth. You have probably one of the single most influential positions to making the profession better. So briefly, before we get into the side about using that, you know, how do you take that? How do you own that? And how do you get started in that internal QC role?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to my knowledge, I believe the American College of Paramedic Executives is building or working on a credential that is like a certified compliance officer, I believe. And so something like that otherwise doesn't really exist. So yeah, there's not really a script. So every state somewhere in their administrative rule or statutes related to EMS likely has language saying you have to have QA program or quality something program. But that's kind of where it stops. It doesn't talk about the details beyond there. You know, we don't talk about Fight Club. You just have to have it there and that's it. So we have to have this. We got to maintain compliance, but there's no details talking about how to structure this, how to build the framework, how to execute it. And I think now at least that's changing. So that's good. As far as the people to be in that role, you know, there is certainly a black and white data minded influence that has to be there. You know, I'm an ISTJ person, so I'm very analytical, and you know, I appreciate the black and white. However, clinically, you know, we as paramedics and EMTs, we function in the gray, and so you've got to be able to function or at least operate with a black and white mindset, respecting the gray, I guess would be the best way I'd kind of put it. So you've got to be able to take the objectivity and follow that up with the context of subjectivity and be able to communicate that, you know, the other way. Because if you're in that type of position where you are the QA person, above you or senior to you is going to be your administration and your medical director, and then subordinate to you is going to be the rest of the staff. So you've got to be able to communicate upward and then downward what happened, and again, in context, keeping in mind the black and white of whatever policy might be, or even protocol, even though that's gray in nature, you've got to, you know, objectivize it somehow to show that it is indeed got some black and white, you know, this needs to get done, or this is the standard of care in a sense. So it's a unique position, and that's not even talking or factoring in data, you know, data management too. You know, being able to work around an Excel spreadsheet, you know, can help you. But one of the tricky parts of data is just trying to figure out, you know, how do I ask the system to get the information? You know, our PCR platforms have just a wealth of information in them. You just have to know how to ask the system to do it or to find it. And you know, relying on your vendor, you know, is a great way to help do that. But, you know, you as a clinician or as the QA person need to know how to get that information too. And sometimes just a matter of messing around in the system, you know, hoping you don't break it too bad.
All right. So let's go into the purposes of using this for more than just the one-on-one. So I remember when I first started in the profession, you know, you see all these television shows back in the day, going back to George Clooney and ER and stuff like that. And one of the things that you see is anytime something happened, they had what they called M&M conferences or morbidity and mortality conferences. And I'd say those are probably as punitive as could be at that point in time. But now, you know, they do grand rounds and, you know, some of them still call them different things, but that was an opportunity to get individuals to come together and ultimately make a group of people better. So they, you know, they brought the providers in, they talked through the case, they found things get better, get worse, whatever it was. So we can actually translate this data from the QA process into the training environment as well.
Yeah, and, you know, so I agree. That seems to be kind of the origin area of, or the genesis of, you know, what QA was. It was the morbidity and mortality conferences. It was those other forms of review, and I remember sitting in on some of those, too, when I was early in my career. You know, unfortunately, a lot of those, the impetus behind it was something bad that happened resulted in the need for us to review it. And, you know, and that, you know, is beneficial. We can learn from that. However, it's equally important for us to also focus on this call went well. And this was documented well, and a great job occurred. We should also highlight this. So I think that's one part of QA that it's very easy for us to focus on the crappy calls and the calls that just need a lot of work and need some tweaking and fixing. But we also need to make sure that there is positive reinforcement and positive attention that's garnered toward the reports that did go well. And so I think that, you know, with your QA process, being transparent and upfront with your crews to say that these are the types of calls that will be reviewed. And ideally, you know, it's great if, you know, there's one, two, or whatever amount of people that are reviewing, you know, the reports directly and upfront. But ideally, some sort of monthly, quarterly, whatever that looks like, review process with an open forum, that's beneficial to have too. And likely, you know, monthly is good just so you don't get too bogged down. But being able to, you know, review the calls in an open forum, open discussion, anyone can kind of, you know, give perspective on it. And that, in a sense, kind of can act as a bit of a QA process for the QA reviewers. You know, it's one thing, you know, with that grading scale, if a reviewer, you know, consistently is saying, you know, though this call is incomplete, you know, it's compliant but incomplete, so it's a three, it's a three, it's a three. However, if the general consensus of the rest of the group says, no, it actually answers all these questions, you know, you're being kind of hard on these people, it should be a four, well, you know, that's a process or a way to QA the QA-er. Or on the flip side, you know, actually, yeah, I've got way too many questions on this one. I don't think the care was actually as good as it should have been. This might actually have been a two. And so that's the benefit of at least that open forum. So, you know, morbidity, mortality conferences, M&Ms, any one of those open forum concepts, yes, we have to review the calls that didn't go as well or were really unique and heavy ALS drug intensive. But we also need to review the mundanes, the refusals, you know, which are high exposure or high risk calls for us. We need to review those too, and talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly within them.
You know, I like what you said about using the good and the bad. Like, if you're a QA officer, even if you're you're in an agency that doesn't have the resources or whatever, even just sending out an email maybe once a month or once every 2 weeks or whatever with like examples of good things that happen, examples of bad, and you can let the good shine and just don't, you know, mention who it was that originated. They've been the more questionable, or, hey, this isn't really acceptable for this reason, but it does bring up a good point about documentation. Remember to document whatever. But I do like the idea this way that people not only get told by policy what the expectation is, but they get real world examples every month. This way, even if you don't think people are reading those, trust me, they are. The reason why I know that, people read Google reviews. They don't read Amazon reviews and stuff. Yeah, they do. They read them all the time. So even if you send that out, you're like, nobody's going to read this stuff. They might. If you have like 10 good things, you're going to find somebody's like, I'm going to see if my documentation got put on there. You know, so, or if it's on the bad part, it's like, oh crap, I need to see if mine's on there too.
And well, if nobody is, that,
I think there also needs to be an element of vulnerability and leading by example. So if you're going to be in this type of position, you know, especially, you know, for those where it's like a promotable position, a chief officer or something, you know, middle management, you know, you've got responsibility, you've got hierarchy, and you've got subordinates, whatnot, with you and some authority. You need to also set an example and show other people what your expectation is. And I can recall a couple years back applying for like a deputy chief or chief officer position for a QA role. And, you know, they asked, you know, how would you promote this process? How would you try to change the culture? And I said exactly that. The first 10 reports that we review are going to be mine. And no one's going to know that they're mine, but we're going to review them and they're going to be mine. And you can critique the crap out of them. You can be difficult, hard, you know, wanting more detail, whatever. Dissect them and beat them up. But they will be mine and they will be my example starting. Because, you know, my example, at least believing that, you know, I produce a quality product, but that's what we're going to start with. And I'm going to show you that I'm vulnerable and I'm giving that, you know, opportunity to everyone, but then also that, you know, this is the expectation. So that's important too.
So let's talk about, and actually before we even do that, and if nobody, I'm going back to Eric's comment here about reading Amazon reviews. I think everybody has at least read the Amazon sugar-free gummy bear review. That automatically is the first one that everybody references.
So, I'll link that in the description for our podcast. People will go to it.
So let's talk about some of those data points that we can use as we start to wrap up here this evening. So talking about, I know there's some of them that hit you, but cardiac and STEMI, you know, what as a QC officer can we start to use about some of those data points that you see?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, with data, it's more than just response times. I mean, good God, we're all compared to response times and, you know, 8 minutes and 59 seconds and whatever. So getting away from that, you know, we're focusing more on patient outcomes. And so I think that's the key part of the equation that we oftentimes forget about is we've got to have more data respective to patient outcomes. So an easy way to at least work with this and, you know, for some places it's going to be a small N, a small number, and others it's going to be larger, but take like your, if you have, you know, cardiac alert, code STEMI, sepsis alert, you know, any of those type of alert pre-notification events, whatever you have a criteria for, that at least gives you something to, you know, base compliance off of. So with calling those alerts, it's important to see or determine whether or not the criteria is actually effective. Does it accurately catch patients that it should catch? So taking, for example, like your cardiac alerts, you know, a patient who is over 35, has 2 millimeters ST elevation, has chest pain or an ACS symptom, you know, so essentially 3 criteria. If you call cardiac alert or code STEMI to this receiving facility, was that compliant? You know, did the patient actually have all 3 of those things and you documented them, yes or no? And it's just simple, yes or no. And then, did the patient have a heart attack? Did they go to the cath lab, or maybe they denied it, but did they get diagnosed with a STEMI? And again, yes or no. So kind of, you know, building a little 2x2 table off of that, you know, on one side, you're looking at the compliance of the criteria. The other axis is what was the outcome? You know, from there, you're able to at least determine, okay, if I'm seeing a lot of patients who were called as a cardiac alert and actually had a STEMI, then okay, good. You know, our people are accurately identifying it and our criteria stands up to it. As opposed to if our people are saying cardiac alert and they're not being diagnosed with a STEMI, well, then what's going on? Why are we calling wolf? Is the provider just being rogue and not following the criteria? Because they should be following the instructions. Or are we calling cardiac alert, but the patient is not being diagnosed with a STEMI? Is our criteria too sensitive? Or the flip side of that, is it not sensitive enough? You know, that's the part we want to avoid is do we need to recognize, you know, do we need to hone in on our criteria? So doing something like that, utilizing, you know, not only the compliance, but then also the outcome can really help to drive and show, you know, where your protocol needs to be updated or fixed, or if you really are on track clinically.
All right. So a lot of good points from Tim tonight. So we're going to go ahead and start to wrap up for this evening. So Tim, any last thoughts on the QA process that you have from your perspective as we wrap up for tonight?
You know, the biggest thing I would just say is just start. You know, if you're a small volunteer agency, start. If you're a large, major metropolitan agency, then start. So, you know, and if you need help, you know, ask for help. Ask me for help. Ask other agencies for help. Get their idea on what to do. But, you know, we really do need to, as a professional industry, we need to be focusing on quality. And we've got to have some data to back that up. And we're not going to get data unless we're focusing on, you know, finding it and tracking it. And it's not going to be good data if we don't have quality reports to base it off of. So, you know, work on your documentation. Yes, we need to make the red go away, but we also need to make sure that the narrative clarifies and answers what the red can't clarify. So your narrative should be complementing what your drop downs can't clarify or can't explain upon. And, you know, we need to be focusing on what numbers can we produce as a result of the care that we are providing.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And Eric, any last thoughts from you?
When it comes to the QA process, I've always liked the idea of, you know, rising tides raises all ships. I think Bradley said that, like, I think when we first started out with the EMS handoff. And I think a good program that actually incentivizes people to do the right thing and to see that, you know, bad stuff does happen and good things happen too, may actually help with competency and confidence. And that might help you keep people recruited and keep people staying on. Because if someone feels like they're not thriving or they're not getting any better or whatever, then they may decide to leave. But if they're like, hey, I'm starting to get more competent and confident about this whole process, then I think that's when the QA program could really help.
And then we're going to go to the quiet one on the other side tonight, Bradley.
Yeah. So, you know, I started to jump in when we were talking about double documentation. He kind of clarified that. So, one of the big things I think people need to realize is there's five functions of documentation, and that's clinical, operational, legal, financial, and compliance. And if you've got drop-down menus, that's what we should really use to document stuff, because that's where we pull research and data from. And then if it's got, you know, a comment section there, you know, use that for that clarification purpose. If you can't, put it in the narrative. And then, you know, make sure that whenever you document clearly and concisely, because you don't know who's going to be reading your report, as Tim mentioned earlier. So make sure that we do that. Make sure that we spell things right. We say things the right way, that we're grammatically correct. And those are really our important things, because if we can't do basic documentation, that usually leads into poor clinical care as well.
And I'm going to kind of end this by saying, don't be afraid. You know, one of the things I brought up during this was, you know, make sure and proofread, but also have your partner do it. But if we think that we're doing something wrong in documentation, ask the question, whether it's our immediate supervisor, whether it's our partner, whether it's another crew. If you have questions about whether your documentation is there, then do it. But if you get put in that quality control function, quality assurance function, don't be afraid there either. Take the risks to use this as an opportunity to make your service, your providers even better. And hopefully throughout your work, you kind of span that out across the area, and somebody may pick up something you do and use it in their service. So listening to Tim. Now, I do know if you want to reach out to Tim, you can reach out to him on LinkedIn, constantly trying to probe and prod individuals to think and think critically, think better. But you can also reach out to him at any time and just kind of get some of those, you know, those pointers. And so all of us are able to be reached out to and help you. And I do know that Tim is willing to do that. So, Tim, thank you for taking the time out of your evening and coming back to us yet again. I will mention this. You were actually number 11, so both your numbers were actually wrong. And then you mentioned Julianne, and Julianne was actually the first YouTube video that we did two episodes after you as well. So that's that documentation, knowing all about what's going on. So, again, that's what makes us five on Tim's rating. We are thorough, compliant, and complete. So, Tim, thank you very much for being on here this evening.
Nice job, gentlemen. Thank you very much again. And certainly anytime, I'd love to be a three-peat offender.
Hey, we can see about making that happen. Bradley's already penciling you into the schedule there. And for all of our listeners, we always like to end by saying we thank you for listening to our episodes. But without your feedback, we don't know what you're thinking. So make sure and go visit either our website at emshandoff.com or go to us on Facebook, Instagram, and also LinkedIn. If you're not there already, follow in, and you can reach out to any one of us and we'll get right back to you. But we love to hear your feedback. Also, don't forget to go to buy Apple, Google, or Spotify by EMS Today and like, rate, and review there. And also join us on YouTube for all of our live videos. Don't forget to go by and get your nice, I think I'm the only one of the three of us that's wearing it tonight, the EMS Handoff Apparel at PursueOutfitters.com. So on behalf of my co-host Eric McCullough and Bradley Dean, this is David. Take care, stay safe, and always remember the value of your EMS Handoff.